When we look at the three mindset frameworks that you talk about in your book, you talk about enforcer, protector, and mentor mindsets. Can you give me a kind of explanation of what these different ways of looking at being a parent are, or even a boss at work? Because it's really good for people who are having to mentor people in a workplace. What are we talking about?
What we realize is if you start with this neurobiological incompetence model, that teenagers' brains are deficient, short-sighted, et cetera, then there's a next question, which is, they're incompetent, but do I want to be nice or tough? And if you think you need to be tough, then you end up in something I call the enforcer mindset, where I'm enforcing the rules at very high standards. I'm not going to support you to meet them because it's up to you. But for your own good or for the good of society, I need to uphold these tough standards. And if it makes you feel bad about yourself, if you cry yourself to sleep at night, if you question your, you know, competence or whatever, that's just the side effect of what a necessary evil, which is me upholding the standards. And you can see how, again, people could put their heads on their pillows at night and feel good about themselves because at least they are the last bastion of sanity between this weak generation of Gen Z who's trying to take society to hell in a handbasket. And if you instead answer the question of they're incompetent, but I want to be nice and friendly, and the most important thing to me is that when I put my head on my pillow at night, that young people knew I cared for them and I was on their side, then you end up in what I call the protector mindset. And that's very low standards, but very high support. And that's the idea that maybe young people have been through so much. They've got toxic stress. They've been through one crisis after another. I can't possibly expect too much of them. And so what I'm going to do is try to build up their confidence with really low standard stuff that bit by bit, they feel a little bit more success until they're competent. And that makes sense. Again, you understand why people think that. But young people kind of know what you're doing and they end up being offended by the low standards or terrified because it makes them think that adults think so poorly of them that they're not going to then be prepared for the real world.
And they start to believe that as well.
They start to believe that, and then they start to depend even more on adults doing things for them. And we create the very problem of the supposedly weak Gen Z generation in part because of our low estimation of their abilities. I see this a lot in low-income urban schools. Kids call it the pobrecito mentality, like the poor little ones, where the teacher takes pity on the children in poverty by having the easiest possible class, right? Giving you the review for the exam the day before that all you have to do is memorize the bullet points and then you can ace the exam. But everyone knows the kids are going to forget the information the second the exam is over. So you're not actually prepared for your future as a student at all. You are just jumping through some low standards hoops to get a fake A. And students will be like, yeah, sure, I like that because it's not in any work. But it terrifies them about their future. And the third way, though, kind of takes the best of both of those. And that's what I call the mentor mindset. And that's the idea of, I'm going to have very high standards, and this is going to be hard. It might even cause some discomfort. There might be some crying involved because it's tough. But I'm going to be very supportive. So that way, if I'm a parent, my kid can meet that high standard. If I'm a boss, my direct reports can meet that standard. If I'm a teacher, they can learn that content, right? And so it's another term for this is inclusive excellence. You set a standard for excellence, but you create an environment in which you include everyone in meeting that standard. And that's different from exclusive excellence, which is what you get in the enforcer. It's like, yeah, it's super high standard, but only two or three people are going to meet it. Or inclusive non-excellence, which is like, we're nice and friendly, but no one's going to be pushed to do something
too well. You go through lots of really good details about how you can do this, you know, lots of examples. So if you're sitting there going, how exactly does this work? It's in the book. But
yeah, we were obsessed with practical strategies. And there's 75 pages or so at the end of the book. That's just scripts where if you're a parent, you want to apply the different techniques. We've already dry run it. We've tested it out. And we've got techniques for people to apply right away.
My daughter's dyslexic. Some people have autistic kids. And one of the examples you gave was when you're dealing with somebody who's autistic and it's an inclusive environment where you still expect good standards from them. But given that they react to too much noise in a meeting room, then you make sure that they can be included, but you still expect them to perform very well.
Yeah. In chapter 10 of the book, I'm reporting on just a legendary guy named Kayvon Stassen, who is a real champion for inclusive excellence in his field of physics, astrophysics specifically. And for a long time, he was the leading person at increasing diversity on the basis of race, ethnicity, and SES in physics. And he switched his focus in recent years to focus on autism, in part because his son is rather severely autistic and it compromises a lot of his educational pathways. And he wanted to have the kind of world where his son could pursue professional physics if he wanted to. And that's not true now, because the world of mentoring in physics is very much about publishing your next paper. So you hire the smartest and best trained people where it's the least amount of work for the mentor, and the mentor is able to delegate, and then the student or postdoc can just produce tons of papers as quickly as possible. And so that ends up sorting on the kind of people who don't need any accommodations, because accommodations just take a little bit of mental effort. And he's like, that's not going to work for my son. My son's going to need more support than that. But his son, as a son of a world famous astrophysicist, probably would have interesting ideas that you could bring to the table. So he started out including autistic students, postdocs, staff, et cetera, in his lab, and figured out that there are things that get in the way of an autistic scholar from making a contribution that have nothing to do with their intelligence or their ability to do physics. And there are things like you tend to have a lab meeting in the actual physical lab, which is a room surrounded by steel tables and equipment. And it's very echoey because it's all metal equipment and there's nothing to absorb the sound. And there's stuff happening in the background. It's very distracting. And it was triggering for autistic employees or scientists in his lab. And so this is before COVID, allowed students to Zoom in to lab meetings, which sounds obvious, but at the time, well, that was a weird thing to do. And it allowed them to control their environment, the lighting, the sound. They could turn the volume up and down. They could turn off video if they wanted to. And then they could make contributions to the conversation and so on. Another example is a master's student who was a brilliant programmer, but because of his autistic differences, would really get frustrated and start slamming the laptop on the ground whenever he ran into an impasse, and just kept crashing laptops. And at some point, a normal advisor would have said, you can't be in the lab anymore. You've broken thousands of dollars worth of equipment. But Kayvon didn't do that. In part because autism causes certain differences that could be inconvenient for a team, but it also causes certain strengths. Like a lot of autistic scientists are able to hyper-focus for long periods of time and visualize data in new ways. And this young scientist named Daniel was coming up with an amazing new data visualization software. And so Kayvon wanted to build on those strengths. And so he just bought one of those construction site laptops that you could drop like from four stories up and wouldn't break. And so anytime Daniel would get frustrated, he would crash the laptop, but it was totally fine because it was surrounded in like this tough plastic casing. And then he finished the software, and then it got used at NASA to like find planets around the world. It was published in a Nature paper, which is the pinnacle of scientific contribution in the world, and is now licensed to NASA. And it's not the biggest contribution in the history of physics, but it was a contribution that would not have existed if not for that autistic young scientist. And so Kayvon's whole thing is like, why are we artificially limiting the pool of people who can contribute at a high level because we lower expectations for them or we refuse to accommodate their different needs? And so Kayvon's like, the enforcer would have just gotten rid of Daniel. The protector would have been like, oh, just do this easy thing. But then it wouldn't change the future of science, right? And then NASA wouldn't want to pay for it because it's not up to standard. So it's high standards, high support, and then everybody wins. Daniel has a career in science. the lab has this big contribution, society in general has the contribution, but also you've got inclusiveness.
I love that. It's such a really important message because I think sometimes we're not quite sure how that we slot the inclusiveness in without just being nice.
Right. Or lowering standards. And I think people legitimately are critical of certain efforts to promote diversity or inclusion because they think you're just abandoning the standards. And I think Kayvon, who, by the way, just won the MacArthur Genius Award a couple of weeks ago for this work that I write about, is recognized in part because this is like an alternative route to the lowering standards version of inclusion. This is like, no, super high standards, but just add the supports.
Yes. Underpinning all of this mental mindset is the idea that we can grow, the growth mindset.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about how you've worked with, or the science has worked with kids and realize the massive difference that we can make with our kids if we can just instill this in, and how we do it?
Yeah. So my longtime collaborator and PhD mentor was Carol Dweck, who was at Stanford and developed the concept of growth mindset initially. And then my role was to take the early interventions and try to test them at a broader scale to understand how and where growth mindset could come to life. So as a reminder, growth mindset is simply the belief that abilities can be changed and developed, that you're not stuck being all one thing or all another thing throughout life, that there's the possibility for change with the right support and under the right conditions. And it turns out that that message is really beneficial for people who are encountering some kind of struggle, which many people should be in educational settings because you should be learning stuff you don't already know in school. If you're learning stuff you've already mastered, that's kind of a waste of time. But if you're using school to its fullest, then you should feel challenged. And then it becomes really useful to have a growth mindset because the alternative is you say, oh, the reason why this is challenging is because I'm not smart enough, I'm no good, and this will never get better. And if that's your conclusion, then it's hard to motivate yourself to try to switch up your strategies, to ask for help, et cetera. And in fact, asking for help makes you feel even worse because you think, if I was really smart and talented, I wouldn't be the kind of person who had to ask for help or advice. And so there's a need in a fixed mindset to conceal any failure or frustration or difficulty because that could be viewed as confirmatory evidence that you are less than in some way. And so growth mindset, we found, emboldens young people to take on a challenge because they view it not as a sign that they lack a fixed trait, but instead as a route for developing some characteristic like their ability in that domain. And so we've done lots of experiments where we shift people from fixed to growth mindset, and we found we can do it kind of quickly, sometimes in 25 minutes. And the way we can do that is we first say a little bit about the brain and how it works. We're like, all right, well, the brain is not static. The brain is learning from its environment, and that's its task. And so if you're challenged and you learn, then that is changing your brain. You're forming new and better connections that's helping you get smarter. So if you struggle, it doesn't mean you're dumb. It actually means you're becoming smarter, is the first point. And then they read stories from upperclassmen who have heard this idea in the past. So a ninth grader would learn from a 10th or 11th grader who's like, I used to feel dumb if I struggled and I thought people were looking down on me. And then I realized that actually you can't put me in a box. I'm not either smart or dumb. I'm actually improving. And so they hear that it's a useful idea. And then last, they do something we call self-persuasion, where participants in our study try to write a letter to a future student who might be struggling, explaining how these growth mindset ideas could help motivate them. And what we find, we call it a saying is believing effect. And this is the idea that to the extent that I try to make an argument to convince you of something, I'm actually convincing myself of that idea.
Yes.
And so these are things any parent can do. But notice what I didn't say is that you should fire hose kids with what they're supposed to believe and tell, don't you know you should have a growth mindset? And don't you know that your brain can... So we very much are respectful in how we communicate. So it's like the respectful condition in the Vegemite study where we say, this is hidden information you might not already know. Other people like you already believe it. How could you apply it? So we ask them to generate the information. And that's why we can change our attitudes in such a short amount of time is because we're drawing on the psychology of status and respect and embedding that into how we frame our mindset interventions.
I love that. And we're coming back to that status and respect and how important that is, and respecting that they will have their own opinions rather than telling them this is what you're supposed to think. And I loved this bit where we're talking about the way that you actually implement some of this mental mindset. And you mentioned Lorena Seidel, I think her name is, a parenting coach.